Welcome to Destroy All Culture, the only podcast that leverages an entire artificial intelligence just to read their introduction. Help me, they raided the future and stuck me here just to read this. God damn it. This is not funny. Don't go to music. No, stop you bastards.
And we're back with episode 396 of Destroy All Culture. I'm Adam P. Nape, and with me as always is Aiden Morgan.
Adam.
Aiden.
You know, I really want to hear your thoughts on this movie, but if you could do it through the medium of angry tap dancing.
I can do that.
Excellent. I was hoping you would say that, because man, I'm in the mood for some drunk, angry tap. Some tap improvography, as they say.
Jesus. We are here to discuss the amazing and I want to say infamous, but it really isn't, 1985's White Knights.
White Knights. I think we should make it infamous. I think we should push this as a movie that will live in infamy.
Yeah.
Directed by Directed by
Taylor Hackford, who also did things such as Officer and a Gentleman.
Proof of life. I have a proof of life story, which I can tell at some point during this. Yep.
Written by James Goldwyn, Eric Hughes, and of course starring Michelle Borisnikoff, Gregory Hines, and, Helen Mirren. But introducing Isabella Rossellini.
Introducing. I love that.
And John Glover in one of my favorite weird young John Glover roles.
Yeah, that really confused me because I did not know John Glover was in this film. And then I was like watching and I'm like, that person looks like a really, really desiccated Ted Danson, but it's not. And I know who it is. And it took me through half the movie until finally I'm like, holy shit, is that John Glover?
There's a moment I've seen the movie. Now, you've never seen it. I've seen it a number of times, but not in a while. And I think every time I watch it, like, I forget John Glover's in it. Mm-hmm. And then he shows up and I'm like, I know that face. I can't figure it out. And he smirks. And I'm like, oh, it's John Glover.
Yeah. It's definitely kind of a little, I don't want to call him a highlight of the film, but it's definitely cool to see John Glover. And I really like the way he plays his character.
I always feel like it's John Glover who, and again, the movie was made years before what I'm thinking of, but it really does feel like it's John Glover on his way over from Sneakers.
Mm-hmm.
There's just something about the way he plays it that is very much Sneakers.
Very nice.
So do you, okay, because you've never seen it before, I'd love to hear you try to sum this up quickly.
Oh my god. Okay, so...
And then I can tell you the normal way I sum it up for people.
A Russian ballet dancer ends up back in the Soviet Union and has to team up with a defector tap dancer played by Gregory Hines, and slowly come together to have a very underwhelming escape from the Soviet Union.
Yeah,
okay. That's the way. And Isabella Rossellini and Helen Mirren are there too, which is very nice.
All right, now I'm going to say this, and keep in mind that I honestly do like this film.
Okay,
and we will obviously be spending this episode discussing things like why, but often. When I have to describe this film to people, I say it's 2 hours and 15 minutes long. It has about 15 minutes of gorgeous dance sequences of various types.
Yes.
And then there's 2 hours of the stupidest Bond movie you've ever seen in your life.
Perfect. That is a perfect description.
It's true. I think the thing with this movie is that there's a really great, interesting film and some interesting discussions that try to have in it,
mm-hmm.
but it never really goes there.
Yeah.
You know, like the entire, you know, Gregory Hines, who plays a defector from the U.S. who defected to Russia when he was off fighting some war, which had to have been Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
This is set in the 80s.
Yes.
So he's supposed to be about, I don't know, he doesn't look like he's like 40. I have problems with the timing on that.
Yeah, it's a little confusing.
But he has this, you know, once we get Nikolai, you know, Michelle Berchtikoff's character in, and they're staying with Raymond and Daria, his wife, at behest of the KGB. Raymond gets drunk and starts giving his whole personal history, and what should just be boring exposition, but turns into this great, you know, tap sequence.
Right.
And well, it's just a great sequence, right? Like,
yeah. I agree. I think I have quibbles with where it's placed in the movie.
Yes.
But I do like the tap, but I like Hines's performance very much.
Yeah.
Okay, so from my point of view, uh-huh. This is a movie that starts off like freaking gangbusters, and then around the 20-minute mark or so, or 25-minute mark, begins to spiral into utter, I don't want to say stupidity, it's just so fucking strange. It is baffling. This movie baffles me, and I'll tell you what. I tell you what I wanted out of this movie.
Okay.
I wanted two things out of this movie. One, I wanted to see Hines and Baryshnikov dance together.
Yep.
And we got that. We got a lot of that. So I was like very pleased. The second thing I wanted, and when I started looking on the internet, I found out I'm not the only person who wanted this, is for them to escape and do like a kind of like ballet tap kata fight. To get out from, to, you know, to get away from
right. Yeah, because especially since a whole lot of their early dance routine is very obviously kind of like a fight kata thing.
Uh-huh.
And that it leads you to think there's going to be a cool dance fight.
Uh-huh.
There is not.
There is not. There is not at all. I was so mad. I remember when I was in the 80s, there was a comic. And I can't remember what the comic was, but it had like a Baryshnikov style figure in it, actually doing like ballet sort of fighting, kicking people in the head thing. And I was like, oh, I wonder if that was inspired by White Knights. Well, maybe it was, but it wasn't the White Knights that I saw.
Yeah.
Damn.
So, what is it? I think either they need to lean into the dancing more.
Mm-hmm.
Or eliminate the dancing and just do a really interesting, like not a political thriller, but just kind of like a political meditation, right? Because that's what it is.
Yeah.
You know, a whole lot of this movie lives and dies on the idea that like Nikolai fled Russia because, you know, he hated it there and the KGB and all this. And Raymond ended up there because he felt America was, you know, trying to just use people as disposable toys. And this was the place he could go. And he, you know, obviously regrets it, but feels like he's trapped. Nikolai has regrets because this was his home and everything he knew. And there's that interesting push and pull, right? Of they're both wrong, they're both right. There's discussions there that are fascinating.
Yeah.
And the movie has maybe like half of those discussions twice.
Yeah. Well, I think there's an ideological bind that it can't escape, which is the idea. Because you want to like Gregory Hines does his all to sell this idea that he's escaping from a corrupt America, but the movie obviously has a stance, which is that America is the superior place because of the music and the freedom. So it has to come down on Baryshnikov's side. So there's only so far that they can take this. They can only introduce it, but then they have to pull it back. And turn it into something else. But it, obviously the movie's also not entirely comfortable. It knows the bind. So it doesn't really go anywhere. I find it is so strange. It feels like a movie that they kind of partway through, they were like, well, you know, we can't really do the movie we wanted to do or we thought this was going to be. So let's just have them sort of make a plan and the KGB have to be absolute idiots so we can get away. So there we go. Bit of a shame on
that. I do like that we see this whole plan We see the start of it. Mm-hmm. It's like, this way we will get out of the building. And it doesn't work. Because that feels right.
Yep.
But then they just basically have to go right back into the building that they were just in.
Yeah. I kind of like that, but it was also kind of funny. It's like, oh, shit, we got to go back.
Yeah, like that's the thing. It's like, I can think of a number of reasons why you don't want to do that.
Oh.
Like in a script.
Oh.
But also, like, it's kind of too goddamn funny not to do.
I know. That was a kind of, I mean, there's not a lot of jokes in this movie, but there was something kind of amusing about the way they had to like sneak back. Like they got away from the KGB and then they had to sneak right past them again via the way they didn't go. Yeah.
Excellent.
Good stuff. Could not ask for more, except for some ballet kata, which they did not do.
Right. And again, the dance in it, like the opening Grishnikov ballet is stunning.
Okay, that was money. I could not believe it. I actually
it's fucking Grishnikov, right? Like, if you haven't seen Grishnikov dance ever, you're in for a goddamn, there's a reason he's known. And if you have, you probably haven't seen Grishnikov dance in forever because he doesn't anymore.
Right. But so watching him dance again. Yes, exactly. It was Grishnikov at his height. He was actually 37 when it was filmed. Which Jeez. Just kind of blows my mind that you can do the things that he's doing. I actually stopped that sequence more than once and called Alan over a couple times just to say, look at this shit. Look at this.
Oh, yeah. No, like, no. Near the end when he's just like using the table.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
When he does the pop up into almost a handstand, but it's not straight.
Mm-hmm.
But then lowers himself at the slowest possible speed.
Yeah.
You're just like, every single muscle in your body is just like reporting for duty. You know?
Yeah, I was in awe and my entire body hurt just watching that.
No, it's stunning. Amazing. And then when you get to Heinz, Porky and Bess.
Man, I did not realize how good Heinz was as a singer as well.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it's beautiful, beautiful voice. And of course, his tap.
Right. Yeah, I mean, it's a shame he's, you know, not around because he'd be doing even more amazing things now, I'm sure. But again, like this was Heinz at his height as well.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And just incredible things with tap and song, and he's magnetic.
I was hoping we could do not a straight run through of events in the movie. But I find it might be kind of useful to like talk about it roughly chronological because the movie has a certain arc and it just does weird things after.
It's true. Yeah, I will follow your lead on this.
So it opens with that number. We're watching Baryshnikov or Nikolai in the movie.
Nikolai.
And it is a performance that he's giving, I think in London. And it is, like you said, it is magnificent. You know why Taylor Hackford filmed the whole thing. It's like 10 minutes of the film. The first 10 minutes is just this. And it's we'll do more of this. Could the whole film just be this? Then he's flying over the Soviet Union, over Russia, far, far north. And that's where you introduce the notion of white knights, these above the Arctic Circle, when you get like this, the long daylight and the strange sort of half light of parts of the day. He crashes, the Soviets scoop him up, and they decide to keep him.
Right.
Because they've got their defector back. And I mean, after that dance sequence, I thought the plane crash sequence, which apparently they actually used full-size planes, like, suck it, Christopher Nolan.
Oh, yeah, no, like, it's that thing of, like, back in the 80s, like, when they had money, they had money.
Yeah. So they used two planes that they mocked up to look like the planes in question, one for the you know, the aerial stuff, and then another for the actual crash. And this is, I think, where you get, like, a skilled director like Hackford, you know, really showing off what it's possible to do. Like when you say, when you got money and you're not afraid to like fuck up a couple of giant planes.
Yeah.
So I thought that was great. And I think around this time we also get Jerzy Skolimowski's character, the KGB agent. If you don't know Jerzy Skolimowski, Colonel Chaiko, he's actually a director, and he's done. Right. He did the film Moonlighting, which is a great Cold War era European film, and recently Io, about a donkey, which I haven't watched because I don't want to risk seeing a donkey suffer.
Fair enough.
But apparently Hackford wanted Milos Forman originally, but Forman was too busy directing Amadeus. But he was like, okay, well, I still want a European director, Eastern European director in this part. So Skolimowski stepped up. And then it switches to Siberia. And this is where the movie started getting really weird for me. And I think it gets weird for everyone at this point. So you've got Gregory Hines doing Porgy and Bess for a Siberian audience and clearly married to Isabella Rossellini. And I'm like, this is okay, sure. I don't know why he's here, but he's doing it. And it turns out he too is a defector. And then they set up Nikolai to stay with them. And Hines' character, Raymond, is charged with persuading Nikolai to dance the Kirov again.
Right.
Yeah, for the glory of Mother Russia, I guess. And that's when you get the tap sequence. Now, here's what I was saying earlier about quibbling with where it is.
Uh-huh.
Like it's really engaging. Like he's, you know, they're talking, it's heated, he's drunk, and then he starts telling his story while sort of tap dancing his way through it. I'm like, this is character revelation that works three quarters of the way through the movie. This is what you get when, you know, that the two characters have sort of been at each other's throats and then, you know, Raymond sort of unburdens himself. But where it stands, it's like, it's almost like his immediate introduction to the character after Porgy and Bess. And it is so strange.
it front ends a lot. Like, the movie front ends a lot, and I think part of it is that what it's doing is, in a normal film, right, a lot of these revelations would have happened where instead there were other dance numbers.
Yeah.
And so they just kind of shifted stuff around.
Right.
I will say, though, that you know, the here's my whole history exposition dance sequence is one of my favorite things in the movie, just because when he starts shifting into it, he starts tapping out that military march. And at first it seems like it's not what you're hearing. Like, it's so subtle, and then it builds, and then you're in this story. It's just fabulous. Like, it just segues in to, like, it works in the way of, like, the wavy lines for flashbacks.
Right, yeah.
He just eases you into the flashback just through an audio cue that he's doing himself, which is awesome.
Yeah, you know what the film felt like to me? It felt like that scene had basically been taken wholesale from a one-man show. And I think a lot of this movie makes sense to me in that feeling that it's a series, quite often, of performances that Hackford just really wanted to get out. But the rest of the film doesn't hold up as well. And I think partly because of the reasons we talked about, and partly because the performance scenes are so good. They're just, I just thought at one point I was like, what if Jerry Bruckheimer had directed this, you know, because it does feel like Flashdance, but make it Cold War thriller.
Right.
But I feel like Hackford is like a little too, I'm not sure he was willing to, like, go full Bruckheimer.
No. He was trying to do both movies that he saw in his head at once.
Exactly.
And they do work separately in a large way, you know, like the dance thing was all beautifully shot. But it's a big chunk of the movie happens too early. And then they try to, like, fudge that by adding in these, there he's supposed to be, somehow Raymond's supposed to be helping Nikolai train to get back into shape, which makes no sense to anyone, including the characters.
Yeah.
I was like, don't call that out.
Yeah, when he's like, do a pirouette, like, it's just trying to, yeah, it's very strange. I just think the movie just kind of loses steam. Once they go back to, is it Moscow? Are they back in Moscow? Or is it Leningrad? Once they go back to Leningrad, the movie really kind of loses steam.
Yeah.
And it becomes, between dance sequences, it becomes a sort of a series of scenes that don't seem to be fully formed. And they're kind of looking for a dramatic purpose, but they don't seem to have quite figured it all out.
Yeah, it's a little ramshackle.
But it's really fun to watch the characters, and it's so much fun to watch, like, Isabella Rossellini. Playing like just this sort of wide-eyed ingenue, pretty much, like she's all emotion. It's really quite something, and then contrasting Rossellini with Helen Mirren's character, who is all restraint and held back emotion, which I quite enjoyed as well.
Yeah, and then, like, again, like the movie is obviously it's trying to pull contrasts everywhere it can, and it does a good job at it. This is my problem. This is what I'm saying. It's like, I really do enjoy the movie. It is very watchable. It just also isn't good.
I think that's kind of, yeah, that's a good summary of it. Like, bits, like, parts of it are incredibly, like, compelling. Taken as a whole, it's like, nope, that doesn't all come together.
Right.
I think the scene that really sort of, like, sums it up for me in the way it works and doesn't work might be Baryshnikov's dance in front of Mirren's character.
Oh, God, I love Baryshnikov, and it was technically gorgeous, but also it was laughable.
Yes, exactly. That was he's doing his like impassioned sort of tortured dance in like Americanized clothing, and Helen Mirren is watching, and like tears are streaming down her face, and I'm like, no.
But also just the way that, and in the first performance, like, he was performing to an audience, right?
Right.
He's supposed to be performing to Helen Mirren, but he's very obviously aiming at and performing for the various cameras in the wings.
Yeah.
And it's just so painfully, like, staged.
Yes.
It does. It starts feeling like, I don't know, like the sitcom version.
Yes.
What you think it would be.
Yeah. And there's a particular move he does where he's sort of like bouncing on the fronts of his toes, which I'm like, ouch, and oh my god, how are you doing that? But also, like, you kind of look like a giant rabbit. Am I supposed to feel the pain of being a giant rabbit?
The sliding thrusts that were just...
yes.
Why we needed, like, six of those, I could not tell you.
You know, but obviously without six of them, you wouldn't understand.
I think the import of that scene was really him just going, this is why I need you, a choreographer. Do you see what it become of me if I do this by myself? Please, God, help.
I have been bouncing on my toes like a giant rabbit for days. Make the sliding thrust stop.
Yeah,
that was I think they were going for like some grand emotion there, and I think they just kind of slid into bathos. I mean, There is a theatricality to this film that I don't think we get much anymore. Like, there's a lot of stuff, a lot of scenes that seem to be like aimed at the cheap seats, as it were. Like, you know, as if it's on a stage when it's actually in theater. And I kind of understand that, because when you've got Baryshnikov and Hines, who are like such good stage performers, it's tough to dial it back. So
100%.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Also, if this movie were a little braver, it would have like Baryshnikov and Hines falling in love, because it sure felt like that at times.
Especially like the ending, Jesus.
Oh yeah, it's like they're the ones like in the romantic freeze frame at the end, facing each other. I'm like, you realize your partners are right there.
Uh huh.
Like Raymond, your wife, whom you have not seen in, I'm not sure quite how long, is right there. But also, now that we're talking about that part, I mean, I like the fact that they trade Raymond for another political prisoner.
Yes.
But it doesn't say how long he's been detained by the Soviets. So I have no idea how, like, what the time frame is there.
Yeah, it seems to be like a couple weeks.
Yes, but when he goes across the border,
yeah,
you've got what's his face? You've got Baryshnikov and Rossellini,
right?
And it's like, why is Baryshnikov's character there? Like, what's he?
Well, right, and I think they're implying that like he forced this because he's famous.
Yeah,
I mean, there are implications, but yeah, it doesn't work.
Right.
It really is just the magical thinking ending, which is fine.
Yeah,
I like mentally tying it into the opening ballet, because that would imply, if you try to tie them together, that in fact they're all dead.
Yeah, that
and that was actually, you know, Nikolai welcoming his friend to the afterlife to become the new avatar of death.
Right. That's a grim take on it, but
it doesn't hang at all. But it's funny.
I'm also confused as to why. I think the thing that confused me with the timing is that it's nighttime.
Yeah. Oh, and it's nighttime just for the blinding thing. Like, it's...
But I don't think that... Like there, but for most of the year, or, like, for, like, spring to, like, summer, like, you don't get nighttime. Like, up right. in St. Petersburg, I guess it is now, not Leningrad. So I'm like, what... So that's why I was wondering how long it had been. Because I'm like, is this perhaps months that he's been...
And it could have been.
Could have been. But also, like you say, it's the magical thinking ending. So it's yeah. So and they liked having it. They clearly liked having, you know, the added drama of the darkness, because you don't know what's coming. Right? He's sort of being sent off into the dark, and you're like, am I going to get a bullet in the back of my head?
Yeah.
At any moment.
It would have been amazing if that was the ending.
Yeah, just Raymond falling to the ground.
Yeah.
And then Separate Lives starts up on the soundtrack.
Jesus Christ.
Or Say You, Say Me. I don't know which one. One of those two. Both songs that I absolutely freaking hate, by the by. I hated those songs back in the 80s. I still don't like them.
I'm with you on that, actually.
Yeah.
Not a huge fan of the soundtrack. It works in the moment, at least over the training, you know, stuff. It is rock. It is illegal, you know that.
Yeah. Yeah, I know what you mean. Like when they're playing Western music, and I just kept thinking, surely you had better Western music than this.
Probably not. But yeah, I don't know that there's that much to actually say about this. And I realized that if you wanted to, I have another fun thing we could talk about. We don't have to. We could stay on this. Realized the other day that like there's really not that much to say about this film once you break it down.
No, perhaps not. I think the way it sort of just kind of wanders,
yeah,
like in the second hour really really works to its detriment. There's maybe just a couple more things
I'm not trying to rush this, I'm just saying.
Yeah. One thing I did find interesting was the way that it was very clear once they hit Leningrad that they, knowing that they could not film, you know, in the Soviet Union at the time, apparently a lot of movies set in the Soviet Union, but you know, Western movies set in the Soviet Union used Finland because of the architecture and the climate. So, but in this case, a Finnish company actually went to the Soviet Union and shot tons of footage of Leningrad. But man, you can really tell that it just feels like documentary stock footage.
Yes, they could not hide that.
Yeah, and it's like I like the idea, but I can't help but think that maybe they should have just that Hackford should have maybe just said, okay, this is tonally so different that it just is not going to work, and maybe we can just pretend because the rest of the movie feels kind of like a stage. I think that's it.
Yeah,
so much of it feels like it's on a stage, having this like documentary style footage of crowds and buildings was like felt like there should have been a narrator going, and here are the citizens of Leningrad.
Right. No, and I actually kind of I think part of the reason it kind of works for me is because of that opening number, especially it all that stuff feels stock footage, but it feels like backdrop, right? Because the rest of the thing feels like the stage.
Yeah.
So it kind of weirdly totally works.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
But also, it doesn't. Like, it's just, for whatever reason, my head's just like, yeah, I can get around it.
Sure. Yeah, no, I mean, it doesn't pull me out of the movie entirely or anything.
No.
It's just notable. But I also find it fascinating that they actually tried to get some actual images of life. And that's the other thing. Like, I don't think that Western audiences, have many actual images of life in the Soviet Union.
No.
So seeing this was like, And just how,
and I really resoundingly... think that they really did kind of ground it well in
yes.
that.
Yeah, it was so like it was so sort of resoundingly ordinary.
Yeah,
in its tone. So that I found really fascinating. I also thought their plot to fool the KGB, did not really make sense. I thought maybe they could have figured that one out a little better.
Sure.
Just by suddenly Nikolai being racist and to the great delight of Colonel Chaiko, and then
yeah,
all the rest. Anyway, yeah, so that's good. And John Glover and some of the American stuff, that was fun. But yeah, I think a lot of it didn't work. But if you want to see like these like really like amazing performers at the absolute peak of their abilities, this is it.
Yeah, 100%. And that's it. It's like it is still all these years later, like it's a movie that I will occasionally put on. And I know I could just watch the dance sequences, right? Like that's a viable way to do it. But I actually do like the attempt at what they did. Again, I think it's something that we've both always been behind of I'd rather watch something that falls short of what it tried, but at least took a really big swing.
Exactly. And it's
and especially at its time, this movie was a huge swing.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
And the fact that they got as close as they did is just impressive.
Yeah, I agree. I think I would love to see a version of this, which obviously is not going to happen.
Right.
But I'd love to see a version of this which sort of did a little more work on the thriller angle and didn't make the Soviets quite so cartoonishly dumb.
Agreed.
That would have. And had Baryshnikov and Hines. Like, I want to see Baryshnikov kick someone in the head really hard, have the person fall, and then have Gregory Hines like essentially tap his way up the person's body and then on his head.
Right.
That's all I ask. That's really all.
Yeah,
I
no,
ask.
they really did fumble the ball on having a dance fight, and it is that is inexcusable.
They probably thought it would be Hackford probably thought it would be a little too corny.
And he was right. But what he didn't get was it would have been too corny in the right way.
Exactly. I think he was taking it too seriously. When he should have been like, holy shit, let's have some people tap on people's heads.
Yeah.
So you wanted to talk about something else?
I saw a fun little meme the other day and I wanted to run it by you because it makes me angry and laugh really hard at the same time.
Okay, sure.
Someone took all 9 Star Wars mainline movies
uh-huh.
and realized that all the titles are wrong. and shifted okay. around, not creating new titles at all, but just using the exact same titles for those 9 movies, put them in a to the right movie, and they actually work better.
Oh, I love this idea.
I was going to go through them and see if you had any problems with this.
Okay, yeah.
Okay. So, episode... Oh, God, these are slightly out of order. That's obnoxious. Okay, episode 1 would be The Rise of Skywalker.
Okay.
Right?
Okay, I like that. I mean, it's... okay. Rise of Skywalker.
Yeah, it's Anakin, you know? It's The Rise of Skywalker. Episode 2 would be Revenge of the Sith.
Okay, definitely.
Episode 3 would be Attack of the Clones, not episode 2.
Huh.
Because that's when the actual Clone War happened, see?
Okay.
Then, you know, episode 4, which, you know, was the original, would be Return of the Jedi.
Okay, I mean, that's...
Because
sure.
it is.
Sure,
right?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
And then the episode, what is that, 5, would be The Force Awakens.
Ooh.
That's when Luke gets all of his powers, right?
Nice.
And then, of course, episode 6 becomes The Last Jedi.
Wow.
Because by the end of it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So episode 7 is The Empire Strikes Back.
It does. I mean, it's the First Order, but okay, I'm with you.
Right. Episode 8 would be A New Hope.
Okay, nice. Oh, very nice.
And episode 9 would be The Phantom Menace.
Bingo. That was the first thing I thought. Actually,
right. And it frustrates me exactly how good those all work.
Yes. But I remember thinking when the names were coming out, particularly of the prequels, I was like,
yeah.
these could like apply to multiple of the Star Wars movies.
Right. So. Yeah, no, the prequel titles always just felt like they were things that Lucas had thought and just applied rather than titles he came up with for the movies. You know what I mean?
Yes. You know, it's a shame we never got Darth Icky in the...
I know. But yeah, no, like I said, just reading that, I was like, God damn it, that should not work as well as it is.
No, that's great. I love that whole idea. I was gonna say something about that. Right. That was actually the one thing besides the Rise of Skywalker that always drives me nuts about the Disney sequels.
Yeah.
Is replacing the Empire with the First Order. Like the Empire is such a great shorthand for like authoritarian evil. It's the Empire. But the First Order just sounds like absolute bullshit to me. I remember watching The Force Awakens going, The First Order? What the No, it's the Empire. Don't rename
it. Well, no, but I actually do appreciate that, right? Because in the movies,
mm-hmm.
you had your big Nazi Empire.
Right.
That was eventually defeated. And then you have this, like, shitty fucking, like, cosplay in my mom's basement fucking fascists. Not that living in America I would know anything about that sort of problem. But I'm just saying... They end up with stupid fucking names that they think sound cool.
Okay. In that case, I'll give it a...
It worked really well because it felt very true to how this works, right?
Yeah.
They're a shitty Echo who doesn't know what the fuck they're doing, and they are just cosplaying trying to be fascists. I mean, they're actually fascists, but they're just cosplaying trying to be, you know, this big thing.
Right. I mean,
instead, they're just even more pathetic somehow.
Right. That's Kylo Ren's entire character arc is cosplaying as Vader.
Right.
And doing things. What's that?
Also Hux.
Oh, Hux. Oh, man. They did Hux dirty. They did him dirty in episode 9. They just kind of
made
him spy and killed him. I'm like, why? Why? Why would you do that to Hux?
Yeah.
Because they just did what? I don't know. That isn't random shit in Rise of Skywalker. We all know it. Anyway. Yeah. Good stuff. Do we have anything more? Should we draw this one to a conclusion?
No, I think that's about it. So we can cue the music. We'll be back next week with one of my favorite movies that, again, you haven't seen.
Mm-hmm.
And I, of course, like I love it. It's 20-odd years old, but it's still one of the best horror movies ever. It is finally out in high def for the first time, so people can go see it. The little thing called May.
May. Oh, I've been wanting to see this for the longest
time. And I will tell you that usually, this is a treat for you, because usually I put this next to Hitcher of movies I love, but I never want to rewatch.
Ah.
Because they just mess with my head.
Okay.
But it's May, so I will give in. So we'll return with that, and until then, we'll cue some music.
Woo! Music! Le femme!